Welcome back to the penultimate Behind the Lens for next week's season close of 10 years. Wow. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound mixers, some of my favorites, the VFX gurus, composers, authors, choreographers, you name it, we talk to them. And over the past 10 years, we've been talking to a lot of really great, great talent. A lot of Oscar winners and Oscar nominees have been on the show. Today, I'm very, very happy because we're going to kick off the holiday season, which will be a short one for us. It'll be this week and next week. And then Pam and I are off for 2 weeks for the holiday, and we'll see what happens with BTL for year 11 in 2025. But today, midpoint of the show, we've got writer-director Nico Santucci joining us to talk about his debut feature, narrative feature, Sarageto. It is a beautiful, exquisite film. It is a blending of sensibilities from East and West philosophies, deals with some very sensitive subject matter, but it's a beautiful, beautiful film. I can't wait to talk to Nico. But first, we had to do it. We're kicking off the Christmas season with none other than Simon Phillips. Hey, Simon.
Hey, yeah, how you doing?
I'm fine, my darling. How are you?
I'm good. I'm getting festive already, Debbie.
Well, I'm festive, too. In honor of you calling in today, I'm wearing my Die Hard is a Christmas Movie t-shirt. I have my Christmas Yodas sitting on the tablescape today. So you are why I'm festive.
Well, glad to hear it.
And of course,
thank you for having me back.
Oh, number four, fourth time.
I know. Fourth time's lucky.
Well, it's always lucky when you're here. And of course, now we have an appearance war happening between you and musician director Frank Meyer, because Frank has been on the show four times too, and Frank is like,
"Well,
go ahead.
I got to beat him, Debbie. I'll have to come back again then."
Well, obviously you'll have to do that, but yeah, you know, but Frank, he was supposed to do the show next week, but he is shooting a music video next week for the latest single for his group, the Streetwalkin' Cheetahs. But he plays with six different bands right now. It's amazing.
See, he's making me sound lazy.
No, you're busy writing and producing stuff. And plus he's going out on tour. He just did weekend gigs with Fear in Florida. He was in Europe earlier this year touring, in Spain and Italy, I think with Fear, but he plays with all these different bands now. They all come looking for him.
But
he's pushing. He wants, like they do on Saturday Night Live, but he wants, when he makes it to five times, and I've already told him he's got competition to get to five, he wants a satin behind the lens jacket. So.
Well, fair. Not to be outdone, Debbie, I shall be wanting the same thing on my fifth appearance.
And you absolutely deserve that. So don't you worry about that, Simon. I don't know about a satin jacket, but maybe a behind-the-lens t-shirt for sure. Five-timer. But I am so, so happy that you could join me today, because Silent Bite is really the only Christmas movie. There are a couple out there. There's Red One that's in theaters. And then there's the best Christmas pageant ever that's on coming to some funky streaming channels I've never even heard of until the press blast this morning. But there aren't any really good Christmas movies that you can take a bite out of, like Silent Bite.
There isn't.
And leave it to you to come up with one of the greatest Christmas movies ever.
Oh, it's very kind.
I have paid for this on Amazon 5 times already. I should have just bought it, but...
I was about to say, at that point, it would have been cheaper for you to just have it, probably. Blu-ray, probably even.
but that's okay. It's your film. You know, your producer, your writer, and you play the wonderful Father Christmas in this wonderful holiday tale of a gang of bank robbers who pull off the greatest heist of their careers. And they hide up in a motel in the Jolly Roger Inn, where they run into vampires. Only you could come up with Vampires Christmas and a bank heist.
Listen, that was my kickoff thrust for this. Was like, do you want to hear what it was?
Yes.
The one-line pitch for this?
Yes.
Right. Reservoir Dogs meets From Dusk Till Dawn set at Christmas.
Oh, that's perfect. Perfect.
Everybody was like, okay, I get it.
That's perfect. But I love this so much. The characters are so funny. The names that you came up with, your Father Christmas, you've got some great performances here in the cast. Nick Biskupic is Grinch. Michael Swatton is Snowman. Dan Molson is Rudolph. Luke Avellato, who I adore, he's Blake, a.k.a. Prancer. He's kind of like Bob. You know, whenever you throw a Bob in somewhere. But he is adorable. And then you have all the sexy vampires. And, you know, and the motel manager is a scream. He is a scream. He reminds me of a demented Martin Mull.
I'll tell him that. I'm about to have Christmas dinner with him tonight.
Oh, my.
I'm having an early Christmas party, so I shall tell him that you said that.
It's just, this movie is so fun, Simon. You know, now, I've got to ask you, and you're no stranger to Christmas movies. This is, what, your 5th Christmas movie, I think. You've done Yes, Chef Christmas. You've done A Royal Christmas Crush, where you got to be a king. You've got, it's a Hallmark movie for the whole family. And your mom could be proud of that one. You've got The Nights Before Christmas, Once Upon a Time at Christmas, and now Silent Bite. So you're keeping
me... these are very different Christmas movies, Debbie, obviously. Some of them are very family-friendly, and some of them are not.
That's right. And I like both, but I really like Silent Bite. So now, once you have this great idea... How did you go about crafting this? Because I know with The Mousetrap, you told me that you wrote for the space. You found the location and wrote for the space. Did you do same thing here?
Well, better than writing for the space on this one, I actually wrote for the space and the people in it. So lots of these people, over 90% of the cast I've worked with before, and I wrote it with them in mind. So I wrote it with, I didn't have to go through a casting process. I wrote it with the people in mind. And then when I wrote the script, I actually just put their names in it. So I just put Michael as Michael and Nick as Nick and Sienna as Sienna and Sailor as Sailor. And I just said, you know, I've written the names so that you can spot who you are easily. But also you will, the people that you think that I'm writing are, you know, we're all sort of friends. Lots of these guys have worked together on various projects of mine and others before. So it was a great experience because 90% of who I wanted to be there was there turned up on the day. So that was great.
Oh, my gosh. But, I mean, this, it's just so clever, Simon. Of course, everything that you write is very, very clever. Be it Stealing Chaplin, be it Mousetrap, I can't wait for your sequel. I'm dying. I cannot wait. Mousetrap, welcome to the Mickeyverse.
That's coming. That's coming.
I'm counting on that one. And no lawsuits from Disney yet. So, hey, you're doing fine.
Exactly. It looks like we might make it through Christmas without being sued by Disney. So there you go. Every cloud there, Debbie, has a silver lining.
That's right. My goodness. But now, once you had this script put together, how did you find... Now, you knew that you'd be shooting in the Jolly Roger Inn?
Yes, I did, actually. So I already knew the space. So that's why it's the way it is. So, you know.
You make such good use of that space, Simon.
It was good fun.
You really are one of these writers and filmmakers that when you're writing, you really think it all through in terms of, you know, where can cameras go, lighting goes. You consider your cinematographer, and you make everything work in terms of using all of your available space properly.
In Venice, that's hats off to Tim Davis, who is the cinematographer and who arranged all the lighting. So he also has a big, along with Taylor Martin, and her team that, direct and do the production design, I was like, I wanted to look like Christmas threw up in this place. So please go nuts.
And guess what? It does.
Good. That's what we wanted.
Well, except when we're in the vampire rooms.
Well, yes, obviously they're not in the festive spirit. They're more in the occult spirit. They're more Halloween-y. We're more Christmas.
However, they do embrace red.
They do. We always get a little touch of red in there just so the audience know that we're magically linked together.
Of course. And of course, you know, when they're celebrating Satan, Satan is all about red.
Well, there you go. So it's a popular color all round, really, in this movie.
And you've got Satan, Santa. Move those alphabet letters around and they're interchangeable.
Exactly. See? And we're not, unfortunately, we're not the best kind of Santas. So.
But you look so good in a Santa suit.
It's not my first time wearing one.
I know.
Now, I've donned the suit a couple of times before.
And I'm sure you will don it again.
Yes, probably.
what is your, granted, you like horror, you like dark comedy. Obviously, Christmas. You are drawn to Christmas. What is it you love about? You're not?
Love Christmas.
Okay.
I do. Like, it's one of my favorite times of year. I actually love it. Somebody asked me the other day, because on the release of this movie, they've worked out that I do a lot of Christmas horror movies, particularly. Mm-hmm. And they're like, wham, what did Christmas do to you, Simon? And the answer is nothing. I'm wonderful. I don't have any traumatic Christmas story. In Gremlins, where the girl breaks down and she tells Zach Galligan what happened to her one Christmas. I don't have that. I was like, all of my Christmases have been very nice. I just love turning the holiday on its head a little bit, because you get a bit sickly sweet if you watch just Hallmark movies.
Yes.
And you're in too much of that things. But you still want to be entertained over the Christmas period. And so we offer something. It's like Die Hard, like the alternative Christmas movie. We give you something that's good fun to watch, but isn't sort of sickly sweet.
Yeah. And then you punctuate, especially with Silent Bite. You really have so much comedy happening in here. And it's not balls to the wall, one laugh line after another. It's the sly way that you craft dialogue. And it's the performances of your fellow actors that really imbue comedy in their delivery. It's just, you just listen to some of this. You're there in the bar, which just, I love the Christmas lights that Timothy did in the bar, where you guys are hiding. It's beautifully done and very Christmassy, normal Christmassy. But as we're fingering the money, and Nick as Grinch, he's just like, nothing makes him happy. He's just miserable. He's just awful. But the whole idea of the money there, and everybody starts, can we take the money? Let's just take the money. Let's just take the money and go. And you're there. Keep your hands off. No, no, no. We're waiting. But the attitudes that they bring to these characters that you've created are wonderful.
Oh, it was they're all very talented guys. So to be honest, it was very easy to write in their voices, because I knew exactly what they would do. And they did more than that. But I knew that they'd be able to handle it.
Now, how early did Taylor, your director Taylor, because this is her first feature, I think.
It is. I met Taylor at a film festival in Buffalo, New York. And I saw one of her short films. I was terribly impressed with what her and her team had done. So basically, when I I said, I have an idea for a movie, which was Silent Bite, you know, sort of, but I don't, you know, like, if I'm going to get you to do it, I want you and your whole team to do it, you know, like, I want you to bring your people, because I really liked the look of her short film that I'd just seen. So I was like, yeah, so, I mean, if you come and bring all of your guys, then you can direct it, you know, sort of, and it's this script, but it's this cast. So she didn't have... She didn't have much say in the cast because I knew all these guys and I wanted my guys all to be in it, you know, sort of. So I was like, no, I've written this specifically with, you know, actors I have in mind. So, and she was fine with that, sort of. So, you know, not many directors would like to be taken out of the casting process, but Taylor was a very good, you know, co-producer director on that sort of front.
Mm-hmm. Now, how involved, because you're also the producer on the film in addition to the writer and, you know, one of the main actors in it. How collaborative, how involved were you with Taylor? Did she require an immense amount of assistance or collaborative input making the hurdle into a feature film?
Or was not really. No. She and her team have got like their own shorthand already. So they know what they're doing sort of. And once, you know, the actors are there and in costume and assembled, you know, sort of type thing. It's just about them trying to capture what we give them, you know, sort of. So it was, she didn't need much guidance there, because it was all relatively easily laid out for her. So it wasn't like she had to craft up actors and performances. Most of the actors knew each other already. So the sort of the relationships between the bank robbers, the relationships between the vampires, and indeed, like our hotel manager and Rudolph and everything like that, those are already sort of existing actors that know each other. So it was pretty easy for them to all work together because they know each other. They didn't have to have any hand holding. So Taylor had in one way, she had an easy job.
Look at you making life easy for everybody.
Yeah, I'd like to think so.
That is your Christmas gift to filmmakers and actors. You make things easy.
Yes, I was. I'm sure they'll go off and they'll do a ton of more exciting things.
Oh, yeah, but working with you, though, Simon, because you truly, you look at the big picture. You look at the totality of the circumstances in the making of a film, from conception to the bitter end. And yeah. I think that is so beneficial to not just yourself, but to everybody working on a film with you. That you've created.
Yeah, you have to, as a producer, you know, you are the first person there and you are the last person there, you know, like, and you have to be able to see that through right to its completion. For me, that's like, it's the baby, you know, it's your baby, so that's the fun you have doing it, and there's nothing better than sitting on it. We had this trailer ready for the movie in like August or sometime before then. And so it was very fun. I went around to all my friends and sort of showed them this very Christmas festive-y horror trailer. But obviously, I'm showing it to them in the dead heat of August, you know, when we're on other film sets and we're doing stuff. So it's the wrong time of year, but I couldn't wait to unleash it. But I just knew we had to wait until, you know, November, until after Halloween. I was like, well, we got to get the other side of Halloween and then we can release this and, you know, build up to the Christmas festivities. But it's very odd getting excited about a Christmas film in August, but we were, because we were like, oh, yeah, this is going to work. This is totally going to work.
Now, when there's quite a few exteriors here in a snow-laden land. Did you shoot this in the winter with snow, or did that get put in post?
Oh, no. We shot in February up in, the Jolly Roger is up in Parry Sound, which is a town about, I don't know, 3 hours north of Toronto. So it's still very, very cold up there in February.
Oh, it's, what is this with you shooting in snow and cold?
Well, I like snow and cold. I also like shooting in the desert because I like the extreme climates, Debbie. So that's why if I'm ever out Vegas way, I always shoot in the desert of Vegas or Arizona because visually they're just big treats to shoot at. They're not the easiest places to film. But they are the most cinematography-wise. It's like you get free production value because people go, if I just filmed in a normal town on a street, you don't kind of earn any production value. But if it's a winter landscape, it's like people go, oh, that's great, you know. Sort of, or if it's a desert, they go, oh, that's great. you know, like this, you bringing something to the table a little bit. So, but if I shoot in a grocery store, and you don't get any value for that, you know, you're like, oh, well, that's a grocery store.
And I have to say, the night shoots outside in the snow with the Christmas lights and the white, and it's so pristine. They're beautiful.
Yeah.
They're beautiful.
Yeah, we had good fun. It was minus 20 when we were filming that.
Excuse
me.
So
every cast member would tell you.
Now, how do you stay warm? How do you keep the equipment in condition when it's that cold out?
Well, you kind of wrap it all up in thermal. So, like, in Canada, to be fair, people know how to film in the cold. You know, like, number one, they've done it before. Number two, they know how to do it. What the real trick is keeping actors warm so that they don't look like... The thing is, you want it to look cold, but you don't want them shivering and, like, not being able to do their job of, like, you know, acting, sort of. So, you know, they have to have thermals on and things like that. But even then... You know, minus 20 is minus 20. Yeah. It's like nobody can stand it for that long. So you just have to let them run inside and warm up for 20 minutes, you know, and then they have to come back outside. But I was, I know the trick to filming in the cold, which is don't warm up. You must, because if you run into a car and you put the heater on for 20 minutes, or you run into a hotel room and you warm up, when you come back outside, Debbie, it's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of. That going from hot to cold, that'll kill you very quickly. So I've done a few of these movies before, so I know what the secret is. Wrap up as warm as you can, but then stay outside. It's like don't warm up. The time that you warm up and have a hot shower is at the end of the night. But if you warm up in between, you'll very quickly get tired and your body will be all over the place and you'll get sick and things like that. So you mustn't do it. Don't warm up is the key to that one.
So now you have just answered the lifelong question of mine. Why, when I was in elementary school in suburban Philadelphia in the dead of winter and it's below zero, we were forced to stay outside during recess and could not be inside? You have just answered that question for me.
Well, that's it. I'm telling you, you appreciate it when you go back in, but you don't appreciate it if you keep going in and out. That's the road to nowhere, Debbie, for sure.
You know,
I can tell you after making a bunch of films in the snow.
That now I know why we were tormented like that and forced to stay outside during recess.
It's good for your blood flow, Debbie. Don't worry. It's good for you in general.
Is that it? No, I actually do. I like the cold.
Good. Me too.
I'm one of those strange people that I have the fan on even in the dead of winter. I like...
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I
live in Canada.
Yeah.
So, Debbie, out of a love for the cold.
You know, I do like the cold, and there's nothing like it when you go and you touch your cheek and it's like cold in the middle of the night, and it's so easy just to go to sleep like that.
I think you're supposed to actually sleep in a cold room, and you're supposed to wrap up. It's actually better for your metabolism.
But yeah, I really do love the cold. We did for a film a number of years ago. We actually had vodka tastings at a vodka bar that is no more. It was a wonderful vodka bar in Beverly Hills. They had Kaufman vodka, the world's most expensive and purest vodka, which I fell in love with. It's $1,600 a bottle. But
oh my goodness!
But they have these big coats to bulk you to wear when you go into the temperature controlled freezer for optimum temperature of the vodka. And I didn't go in there. I just had a regular broadcloth shirt on, and everybody looked at me like I was crazy. I said, there's no wind. It's just straight cold. I'm fine.
Yeah.
It was quite comfortable. And then if you're tasting the vodka and sipping it, you're warming up anyway. So.
Yeah, of course you are. You feel it much less, don't you? After four or five vodkas, you won't feel it at all.
That's it. You know, people just don't understand these things. Now.
They don't.
I feel sorry, though, for your vampiric vixens who weren't wearing much.
I knew that was going to come up. Yes, they weren't wearing much. Because, Debbie, vampires don't breathe. They don't feel the cold. So there wasn't really a reason to wrap them up, because you'd be like, well, that would look wrong because they're not supposed to be able to feel the temperature.
Mm-hmm. So how...
trust me, I had many a debate with many an actress about this on the set, but that, you know, we were like, yeah, I don't know what to tell you. That's what the vampire lore mythology is, I'm afraid.
Oh, no, I know. And that's one of the things that struck me is because they're not totally covered up. You're actually watching this is more akin to watching a Hammer film where, you know, the vampires were the females, once they were turned, they weren't wearing much. So
what, this is part of your lore. Look, Debbie, my audience here is boys. Now,
yep.
Boys like guns and beautiful looking girls. I feel like I've delivered them both of those things in Silent Bite.
Well, you certainly have, and also quite a bit of blood, and blood looks so good against the pure white of snow. Have you noticed that?
There you go. Yeah.
How much blood did you go through on this one?
It's probably best not to think of that, because it could be measured in gallons, definitely.
But I have to say, the color, whoever you used as the supplier, Simon, the color was great.
Ah, I should. Yes, one thing that annoys me, I'm sure you've seen this, Debbie, in other movies, when the blood looks too watery.
Yes.
And it annoys me, that.
And it looks orange, or somebody's been pierced
like
in a
that.
Certain body part where it should be a deep burgundy kind of red.
Yeah.
And it looks like Heinz ketchup.
Yes, it's too red. You have to have a colder look to the blood, as it were, not a warmer look.
So, of course, I mean, I was very impressed with the blood color. Call me crazy.
Well, I'm going to tell them that, too. Every time you compliment something about the film, you're talking about somebody individual. So I'm going to make sure they all get this note.
But, and things like that are important. It's important to the ambient tone of the film.
One small thing like that's wrong takes you completely out of the movie.
Yeah. And I know we've talked about that before. And because I just see all these little things in films. And very kind Orin Moverman for years kept saying, he said, you look at a film like a filmmaker, you look at a film like a director. He said, you see everything. And it's true. I kind of do. But
that's why we love coming on talking to you about it, Debbie, because you appreciate it.
Thank you. That's like I was talking to Jack Huston the other day about his film, his first directorial. And if you haven't seen it, you have to see it. Day of the Fight.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet. I will have to look that up.
It just came out Friday. But as I told Jack, his attention to detail in this film and the considerations that he has in telling the story, you can tell the family legacy, John Huston's legacy and genes are very strong in Jack. Let me tell you.
It's, I see.
Just all these things thought out. And it's very much how you approach a film. You look at all these little things. And I feel it's incumbent upon me to also see those things because, as you said, there is somebody that has done these things. Some one person or a team. They've done the production design. They've hung all those lights. They've toted all those gallons of blood. And that's important.
It's very important. I always believe that the devil is in the detail on these things. The smallest thing can take you out of a movie. The cinematography can be nice, the lighting can be nice, the actors can be doing a fantastic job. But if something small like that isn't right, it's like it just ruins the scene for you. And then you can't see it. You can't see anything but the glaring error.
Yeah. And that's all it takes is one thing, because then you'll have a different eye in seeing the rest of the film, and you're going to be looking for mistakes.
Yeah.
You're going to be looking for them.
I'm with you on this for
now,
sure.
I have to ask you, what's going on with Mickeyverse? Because I know Mousetrap, did it just premiere in Japan, or is it getting ready to premiere there?
It's getting ready to have it. It's got a full theatrical release in Japan, but not till next year, not till March 2025. But they just announced that it was getting its first run there. The Japanese were cautious people, making sure we wouldn't be sued by Disney. So.
Or the theaters wouldn't be sued for showing it.
Yes, exactly. So big theatrical, 200 screens. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Big thing. And myself and Jamie Bailey will be over there for the premiere, the Japanese premiere.
Oh, my God. That's fantastic, Simon.
It's great news for us. I've never had a theatrical release internationally, like outside of America. It's my first ever one, so I'm thrilled.
And wow. I can't wait to be there. Oh, that is terrific. Now, what's going on with Mickeyverse, though, our sequel? Have you started shooting, finished, or...?
We have started. We haven't finished. I'm not allowed to tell you anything, Debbie, about it, including who may or may not be in the cast.
Oh, I don't want to know that. I just wanted to know where we are in the production status.
Oh, we have begun. We have definitely begun.
And will we see this next year sometime?
No, I think you will see it in 2026. It won't be a 2025 film, or if it is, it'll be at Christmas time. But I don't know if it's a Christmas release. I don't think it'll be ready in time for Halloween, sort of. But I think it will be very ready shortly after.
Well, you know.
But I'm the last to know on these things. I don't decide the release date. We just get them the movie, and then they tell us when it's coming out.
You know,
unless they'll make a film like Silent Bite, which I kind of know when they're going to have to release it, you know, sort of. But I've been wrong about those things. I did a movie once called Blood and Snow, Debbie.
I know. We talked about
that
one.
They released it. They released it in the summer, you know. So I was like, oh, really? I thought this is like definitely a Halloween or a winter movie, and they're like, nah. They released it like in August.
Yeah, and we talked about it in August, and neither one of us could really understand why it was released in August.
I still don't have a great answer on that for you, I'm afraid. Yeah, I thought somebody would go, no, you know, and then offer some really magical reason I could see through, but I couldn't.
Because to me, that was a perfect winter movie.
Well, and the argument was, is it'll still be available in winter. And I was like, well, yes. I mean, yeah, all right, fair enough.
Yes, but you might have gotten an initial, a bigger release audience.
Yes, I would think so. That was my one regret about Blood and Snow, a movie I did really enjoy, but I don't think it quite found its audience, but partially because of when it was released as well. I was like, you know, summertime is a big, tough time to release indie movies, but... You know, people watch less movies because the weather is nicer, so they go out to bars and restaurants much more and have barbecues and things like that. So they watch less movies in the summer than they do in the winter, just, you know, by and large in general. So, yeah, it seemed like it would have benefited from a Christmas release. But, hey, you know, I don't run the distribution companies, Debbie. They won't let me do that.
But would you if you could?
I've tried.
Oh, you've tried. Okay. Do you like having... more input into the distribution of a film, Simon?
I don't have any input into it, Debbie. I just tell them what I want, and then they, you know, just willfully ignore the things that they don't want. You know, like, essentially, when you make a deal with a movie, you kind of hand over your baby, and you can say, right, you know, ultimately, when you're leaving your baby to be babysat by the babysitter, you can, like, right, he likes cookies and milk, you know, but he doesn't like the, you know. But when you leave... and you've left the babysitter with the baby, the babysitter can do anything they want. You know, they go, no, he had Coca-Cola, and we give him chips, you know, sort of. And you're like, oh, okay, well, he doesn't like that. And they're like, well, that's what he's getting.
Oh, my. So now what are you going to be doing for the holiday besides, you know, watching your own films over and over again, your Christmas films?
Well, obviously, that's what I do every day.
Obviously.
But for the holidays, I enjoy making my family watch them as well. So I will fly back home to Dublin, where my ancestral home, where I'm reuniting with my mother and my brother. And they have all probably avoided my Christmas movies, but they won't be able to avoid it when I'm there, Debbie. I'm just going to wrap up 5 DVDs and give each of them the same thing.
Oh, I think that's a brilliant idea. Brilliant.
I will tell them that you said that, but they probably won't appreciate it like you will.
I mean, I would be tickled to death to get your five Christmas movies all wrapped up as a Christmas gift. You know, there's no such thing as, but of course, your mother is going to watch A Royal Christmas Crush. That's the one she's going to watch over and over again.
Oh, yeah. I've got another one, actually. It's called, what's it called? Abracadabra. Oh, yeah, Abracadabra and A Christmas Miracle, which is my brand new Hallmark movie for this year. which has just come out, I think, about 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
On Hallmark. Well, I have yet to see it, actually, yet, but because I don't have the Hallmark channel, oddly. But I heard it's out there, and I had great fun making that, too.
Well, and that I haven't seen that one yet, and I do have Hallmark Channel, and I watch Hallmark Channel.
It's out now, as I gather. I haven't seen it, but it is out.
And because we're getting closer to Christmas, I'm sure they're going to be replaying a lot of them as they do. So I'm going to have to hunt that one down because I was like, why haven't I seen this one yet? I didn't even see any promos for it.
It's coming. Abracadabra. Christmas miracle.
I have another Simon movie to look forward to for Christmas.
Well, there you go. See, I do nothing. I do all this really just to entertain you, Debbie. There's
I know.
No other audience except you.
I know you do, Simon, and I love you for that so very much. And unfortunately, I have to let you go. Because I have another filmmaker joining me to talk about his first feature.
Who is it so I can know who replaced me?
Nobody will ever replace you, Simon.
That was the right answer.
Nico Santucci. He has a film called Surrogetto. And it's got Asian Japanese sensibilities meets Western culture. And it's a beautiful film with a score that is hauntingly gorgeous. Very impressive first feature.
Well, in that case, you tell him from me, and may the film gods be with him, and have a happy holiday.
Thank you so much, Simon. And we will talk again for appearance number 5 in 2025.
Exactly. I wouldn't miss it for the world, Debbie.
Oh, have a wonderful, wonderful holiday with the family, Simon. And
thank you, Debbie.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was the wonderful Simon Phillips talking Silent Bite and a few other things. And now I am so thrilled to welcome Nico Santucci to Behind the Lens.
Good morning, Debbie. How are you?
I am fine, Nico. I am fine.
What's happening in your world this morning?
So far, let's see. We kicked off the Christmas season with Simon Phillips just before you.
Wow.
Exciting. And his wonderful Christmas film called Silent Bite that melds bank robbers and vampires on Christmas Eve.
Exactly the type of film that I don't do. But God bless him. That's fantastic.
But, you know, the film that you do is blending Eastern culture, Japanese culture with Western culture.
Correct. Yeah, that was the real objective shooting and writing the film was to sort of illuminate the variables and how our cultures look at different, you know, our main character is struck with a chronic illness and it's how they deal with it. In the Japanese culture, they look at different ways of how not to burden families and friends. And it's a really unique perspective.
And I have to say, as I just mentioned to Simon that you were coming on right after him, this film, Surrogetto, is so beautiful. There is a delicacy to it. It's very delicate.
It is. Thank
elegant.
You. Yeah, that was my intent. I really wanted to, because it's a delicate subject.
Yes, very much so. And this is where your cinematography and the vision, you've got your cinematographers, Eugene Baiste and Landon Brands. I got to tell you, what they capture, the beauty of Mother Nature, which really incorporate the tranquility and beauty of it, really captures the Japanese sensibility and the whole in tune with nature.
Well, in fact, much of what you see was shot in the suicide forest outside of Mount Fuji. And that is a very sacred ground, mm-hmm. and a sacred land. And I think we enhanced it in a way that shows it in a different light.
Oh, very much so.
That's a pretty dark subject. And that's to many, it's a very dark area. But I tried to bring some illumination to it. And try to open up the subject for discussion, right? Because it's a very unique topic that people don't talk about much.
Yeah, it really is. Now, how much of this do we want to give away, Nico?
Well, that's when doing promotion for the film, it's always difficult where to draw the line.
Uh-huh. Because, on this one, it's tricky.
It's very tricky. So we won't sort of reveal all about it. But I think that your viewers will understand that it's a subject that needs some investigation, and they'll need to sort of tune in to perhaps contribute a perspective of their own to it, really. Because
yeah.
I know that going into writing it, I was sort of on the fence about how I felt about the subjects. And as I shot the film, I began to understand the forgiveness that culture has toward these types of acts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I began to become more understanding through the process.
This is such an interesting, number one, interesting subject, but also an interesting approach. What was the impetus for telling this story to begin with?
Well, you know, I've had the blessing of being near folks from Japan, female Asian friends and virtual confidants in my world that I learned a lot from. And just sort of understanding the culture and diving in a bit through their heads, I was able to get curious about these elements. And I sort of began to put it all on paper in my own vision, so to speak. And ultimately, it developed an incredible script, as you probably experienced in the film. It's a really
mm-hmm.
unique story,
yeah.
frankly. It's just a cool, timeless, beautiful in some ways and dark in others. Depiction of, the culture and how it deals with certain things.
Well, and something else that you do here, not only are you melding East meets West philosophies and tonal bandwidths, but you also, you're incorporating black and white flashbacks.
Absolutely.
With just a hint, a tinge of color during one of those flashbacks.
Yeah, absolutely. All by design. I really wanted it to be three-dimensional art with incredible soundtrack and something that, you know, what I find, interesting about Terrence Malick and his films is that very little dialogue and yet
mm-hmm.
everything seems to be finitely communicated.
Yeah.
So I tried to, in the Malick films, I think you can find yourself getting a little, I don't want to say bored, but sort of looking for a little more substance and dialogue. I think, in my personal opinion, sometimes it goes a little too far where you're 45 minutes into something that there's virtually no dialogue or just sort of whispers, and you're looking for a little more, in my opinion. And so what I wanted to do is create a bridge between a Malick look and a more interesting bits of dialogue, and I think we sort of accomplished that in Serengeto.
I think you definitely did. And I have to say, as I was watching it, the visual structure did remind me of Malick in a number of instances. But as you very astutely mentioned, there's very, very, very little dialogue in a lot of the Malick films. You give us some more here to give us a little more substance.
Right, and a little bit of direction.
Which we kind of need for what's happening.
You know, obviously, who's not inspired by Terrence Malick? I mean, some of the most beautiful filmmaking of all time. And certainly many of my favorite films in my top 10 are, in fact, his films. So I'm obviously inspired. And how can't you be? The stuff is so beautiful. And I just wanted to capture, you know, pictures that made and told a story.
Well, you definitely do that. I mean, using so many of the scenes of nature as interstitials, as the transitions from scene to scene, are just so serene, so calming, so beautiful. The way the light captures, a drop of water and the ripples
exactly
in the water,
yeah,
or the bubbles
spent
of the ocean.
Spent a lot of time on that.
Oh, my God.
As you know,
Nico,
you've been behind the camera. You know what that's like to get those shots.
Oh, my God. Well, I have to tell you. They are beautiful, and each one is more beautiful than the next. And
it sort of builds throughout
yes,
the film, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It really does build into the point where you're just, it's hypersensitivity to every drop of scene.
And yeah, and the color becomes more saturated.
It does. And as we go, it becomes more saturated and it gets more interesting and more engaging.
And we get a lot more sunlight.
Correct.
That must have been a killer to get a lot of those sunlight shots, Nico.
Well, of course. As you know, you're always chasing that in the golden hour. I mean, we were pursuing that throughout. And, you know, thankfully, it sort of oscillated just as I visioned it when I was writing the script. I mean, I saw it coming to life, which is contrasting in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very happy with the product in the end. And I'm very happy to be with Gravitas. It was my number one choice when I was writing the film. Gravitas was really where I wanted to go with this film.
Yeah.
And thank God they're my distributor and my partner. And I feel really good about where the film has gone and where it's going.
Yeah, this is a film that if you were on the festival circuit talking to me right now, I would say to you, have you talked to Gravitas?
Right.
As a distributor. This is right in their wheelhouse.
Right, absolutely. And others had on the circuit. We were very blessed on the, we got very good showings. And thank God there were a lot of people interested from the jump. And my first choice was always Gravitas. So I'm glad that they selected us.
Now, I'm curious, because you were envisioning this, as you just said, while you were writing it. Once you had the script finished, and then you had to actually implement the visuals to accompany what's on the page, how did you break this down to develop the visual grammar that you ended up with here?
You know, I think it was, frankly, it was a bit of trial and error in the beginning as to lens choices and, you know, the type of cinematography. I knew I wanted the look overall, but it took some sort of massaging with my DPs and my talent. I mean, I needed my talent to be patient on many of these scenes, particularly when there were emotions involved. It's very difficult for an actress to bring her emotions up, you know, and then have to do it three times again, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
It's not easy. So I asked them to be patient, and often, you know, it's challenging. So we just massaged it, frankly, because I knew it was going to take some work to get there. And I knew it might take a few different lens packages to see the dailies and just understand exactly where we were going. And I think we got it 3 days in. And as you can almost see it in the cinematography sort of elevating as we go through the film. That's virtually me going through the process with the cameras and the lenses. And I had an idea of the gear I wanted to use, but it changed a little bit as we opened.
What did you end up using for camera and for your lens packages?
Yeah, I used the Amiras,
mm-hmm.
And I was very, very happy with everything that we got. We went through a number. I used wide angles a lot, as you see in the beginning.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic. I just love that big wide lens, the 14s, and it was pretty fascinating.
Yeah. What led you to do your flashbacks in black and white?
Well, I was very concerned in the edit that I wanted folks to really understand the story. It's obviously very complicated.
Yes.
And I needed some clarification that we were going back. And because, frankly, right at the beginning, you're looking at really three or four different periods of time, and mm-hmm. it can get complex. So I wanted some clarity for the audience to say, okay, that's her as a little girl. You know, I wanted it to be defined. So that was part of it. But obviously, artistically, it created that great contrast between that saturated big look and the flashbacks with the father and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, just so beautiful, the contrast there. And it goes with the emotional contrast and the cultural contrast. So you have...
Precisely. That's how I felt. Everything sort of made sense in the end.
Yeah, everything is metaphorically speaking to the other.
Correct.
And complimenting
exactly
it.
Exactly, by design. That was the intention. Yeah, for sure.
How difficult was the casting?
Because... You know, it was, I got to say, it was quite difficult. That was the one thing that we paused on a number of times because we weren't finding the lead. Our lead actress, Ikumi Yoshimatsu, mm-hmm. who is incredible. She, in fact, when she finally walked into a casting session and she told me how the script resonated with her because of an experience in her family. And she actually cried before we even rolled the camera on her about her own personal experience. I thought, okay, this is someone who I can get organically what I need for this performance from this girl from somewhere deep inside her. And that's why she was so spectacular.
Her performance, Aikumi's performance, is amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, she's incredible. And she's a real talent.
And a great counter to Aikumi as Grace is Windsor Harmon.
As such a stud, right?
As Grace's husband, he's frenetic. He's not, you know, it's like everything's on the cuff and she's telling him things. And it's like, okay, are you listening?
Exactly.
She's very thoughtful.
That was all by design. And I knew Windsor could fit that suit so well. And he was absolutely perfect. He's so stoic on set. And he's just so, he's such a pro, just a really old school pro that just, I mean, very rarely did I have to do retakes with Windsor. He's just one take Charlie. Every time we shot him, it was perfect.
It's that contrast between Windsor and Aikumi that just works so well and keeps us reminding us of the different cultural and philosophical sensibilities at play here. And
yeah, I wanted him to be a little bit aloof. Yeah, as you said, a little frenetic and a little less engaged. And she's trying to communicate indirectly these very deep thoughts. And he's sometimes getting it and sometimes it's over his head. And that's the way I wanted it to feel.
Yeah.
That's what creates the loneliness for her.
Yeah.
Is what she feels is a lack of understanding.
And then you bring in Ruby Park. Wow.
So beautiful.
Wow.
Right? And I was so lucky to get Ruby because we had cast someone else, and then her agent called and said, I really need you to take a look at Ruby. And she sent tape in, which we'd been doing everything live. And when she sent the tape in, I said, oh, my God, she's just amazing, really. And obviously she looks like Aikumi, and that was part of it all, right? Mm-hmm. She had to be similar, and they were. And then she came in, and I was just blown away by Ruby. She's another just a gem.
And, you know, very tentative, very hesitant initially. And then when she tries to do things, it's, you know, get away. And then she's having a hard time with something in her life. Just, you know, as Mickey, she is just outstanding.
Yeah, her backstory is interesting. Yeah, it was just, we were very blessed with this cast. And Eric Roberts.
Oh, I mean, Eric.
Yeah, he was just. He likes to do everything on the cuff.
Yep.
And we would take the dialogue and he'd virtually shred it.
Yep.
And say, I've got an idea. And you just roll with it because he's so good. And he's so impromptu. And much of that stuff is just him shooting from the hip.
And I got to tell you, as Dr. Langley, Eric is wonderful. And something that you also do here is, the second time we see him, he's in bright yellow shirt, bright yellow, very sunny, very hopeful. And this is right after we come out of a beautiful sun over the Pacific Ocean.
Correct.
And the way it just goes into the rising sun, the setting sun, future, hope.
It's all symbolic, absolutely. All by design.
And even down to the tie that he's wearing, which is the bright blue and yellow tie to go with the shirt.
Exactly.
Blue
My
sky.
My wardrobe department was so on point with that Ruth Fung wardrobe, and it was just so perfect.
I was so impressed with all the way you tied everything together. Everything in this film is so synergistic.
Well, that was the hope. I'm glad you picked up on all of that because those details were all very sort of painstakingly put together, and I'm glad you recognized that.
I mean, just beautifully done. But a great detail in this film that blew me away is the score. Wow, Nico. That score and the instrumentation.
Yeah, it's big.
The strings, especially, we get into a lot of the deeper, like a bass cello.
I was writing it, I could hear the cello.
I can't imagine any other instrument that could have done emotionally what that does at the moments that we hear it.
Yeah, it's like a virtual heartstring, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a resonating heartstring.
And
he captured it.
Just, now, who was your primary composer here?
Well, Martin Tillman did a lot of the big tracks that you're referring to. He's an incredible cellist. He's a world-renowned cellist, and I think he's on tour right now. But he's also a personal friend, and he was nice enough to come in and lay some incredible tracks in the film.
I mean, just exquisite. And the meld that we have, because there are certain times where the score, it almost has a tango kind of feel.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
No, in fact, one of the main tracks is called a tango.
And you count, and then that's countered with the definite Asian influences, musical Asian influences. And then that's punctuated with the sound of wind chimes on occasion. Just gorgeous.
Yeah, that was all done by Jacob Below, and he's in Germany. And he put together the entire score and the entire soundtrack that's available, I think, on iTunes. And he's talked about a brilliant young composer. Jacob Below is just blew my mind. Every time he'd send me samples, I'd like, it's done. Let's put it in. You know, I didn't need to bounce back a lot of it.
What kind of direction did you give Jacob Martin, you know, with the music, what you wanted musically for this one?
Well, I sent them the film, you know, and believe it or not, Martin Tillman had a very interesting personal relationship to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so these guys were really in tune with what I was trying to achieve. And Jacob is a very passionate young composer, and they sort of got it, frankly, when I sent the film and they saw it the way you did and without music. And they were able to bring another level of emotion to it without a lot of direction, frankly.
Wow.
We're continents away, and I would just send it over, and they'd come back with, you know, responses in music. And it was always on point.
I mean, now I'm going to have to go back and watch it with no sound.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty fascinating because the first cut was I had some sample tracks in, but it was stunning even without the music, and then the music just brought it to the next level.
Yeah, but this score is so beautiful, and knowing that you sent them the film raw, you know, with so no temp track or anything, so they came up with a score.
They did. Jacob
beautiful.
Did. He came up with a theme that ran throughout.
Yeah.
And it was virtually, I think I bounced it back maybe once.
Oh my gosh.
Twice, possibly, but it was almost perfect from the jump.
That's almost unheard of.
We had a great long conversation, about a 40-minute chat about my theories on where the film would elevate in certain areas and where I wanted it to be delicate, to your point, and he accomplished that for me.
But now I have to watch it with no sound.
Absolutely.
Just for the visual, emotional experience.
Absolutely. It takes you on a journey.
How long was your editing process on this one?
It was extensive. Unfortunately, it was extensive. I was traveling at the time. I was working on another project. And, you know, the edits I was getting back were not to my satisfaction. So I ended up getting into the edit. In fact, I built an edit bay for the film. I know. You know, as a director, we should stay out of the editing. But I couldn't help it because I knew I wanted to communicate it. And everything was so delicate that a few frames here, a few frames there. You don't want to lay onto a subject a little bit longer to capture the emotion from it. So I went in and did my own edit at the end. And it took, honestly, it took a couple of months to edit it.
Mm-hmm. That's not bad.
It took some time. Well, I mean, that's after it was edited.
Okay, So that's you know, after we've already had some edit.
In fact, the film was virtually complete, and then I went in and spent another 2 months on just sort of finitely detailing it.
Well, there's so much in here that I can see where you would want things to the finite details, especially when you're trying to tie the past with the present and maybe the future. and you really need to hold, and we need to see the little girl, and we need
precisely. You have a very keen knowledge of it, because exactly it was that. It was the little girl very often, and making sure we hung on her for another 8 frames just to get that fulfilling satisfaction of the facial expression or the dialogue, or all of it was so critical to me to really communicate the message.
Because understanding the little girl is key to understanding the rest of the film. And I have to say, one of the most beautiful moments in the flashback with the little girl is when she breaks the urn and she really doesn't understand it, and she's crouched on the ground.
And oh my God!
Wide-eyed. And then slowly, you see on the right of the screen, just some mist or cloud or dust coming up.
Exactly.
And going out into the ethos. Oh my, Nico! Stunning.
I know. It's a tough moment to watch. Even now, when I watch it, that scene just takes my breath away, and you can't help but well up looking at her and all those emotions contained and the uncertainty in her eyes.
It was a tough
scene to shoot, and it was tough because her mom was there on set. And I said to her, listen, this is going to be a tough scene. And I said, how do you feel about it? And she said, listen, she's capable of it. And I said, okay. And we shot it, and everybody on set was in tears, including the little girl.
I mean,
we were all sort of, it was tough. It was a tough day.
But it's so key that you held that shot so that we could see not just her, but just to see that the dust, the wind.
Exactly.
That is so important. And I can see many editors and directors might have cut that off, but you let
that. Absolutely. And that was one of the shots that I hung on in the edit bay and really, really massaged was that shot. Oh,
I'm so glad.
I knew the importance of it.
I'm so glad you did that, Nico, because it is exquisite. And it is powerful. And similarly, in the third act, where it's very languid, it's very vibrant. It is very, very, very saturated neon green almost with the trees, mm-hmm. with the foliage. And the lighting changes. And
it does.
We've got, I like to call it the GE bright white.
Absolutely.
And that just makes the color green pop even more. And that's really all we see, green and white.
By design. Well, as you know, it's sort of the, I don't want to reveal too much about the film.
Don't reveal it.
You know, it's a new world.
Yeah. But you have this book ended so beautifully with everything just tying together. So I'm curious, now that you have it done, you've gone on this journey to tell this story of Sarah Ghetto. And this was your first feature, was it not? Directorial?
It was, as a director, it was. I produced a bunch of films, but this is the first time I directed.
So now, what kind of learning curve did you have with this one, bringing it to life, with all the moving parts?
What I learned the first 3 or 4 days on set was that I would do nothing else in my life. I love directing. I love sort of telling a story with pictures, and that was the biggest lesson I took from it. And I learned that you need to earn the respect of your cast and crew. And my concern was, as a first-time director, that there would be some pushback. And there was, of course. And there was a point of which ultimately I threw the camera on my shoulder and shot the second half of the film.
Oh, my God.
Because I felt like the cinematography wasn't quite resonating. And so it's a fine line of how to gain respect from your cast and crew and capture exactly what you want. And if you massage it well, which we did, I think you can get there. So my takeaway was that I would do nothing else after this film but direct. So thankfully, that's the case, and I'm working on the film now.
Well, with all of the cinematic tools that you were working with, was there one hurdle or one aspect that was that you thought was the most challenging for you?
You know, I would say it just seemed like, you know, to get there wasn't anything particularly technically. We were able to get through most of that. Emotionally, I think, is where I would, you know, say that we would not really run into some issues, but having your talent needing to repeat certain emotions was tough.
Yeah.
And I understood that. I knew that wouldn't be easy, but I needed what I felt like I needed what I needed to tell the story. So I had to push my talent a little farther than perhaps they wanted to be pushed. So there's a very delicate way of accomplishing that. And I'm hopeful I did that because I'm very sensitive to people's emotions. Obviously, you learn that from the film.
Yes.
But at the same time, I needed to capture that essence, and it took a little provocation in some instances.
Well, whatever it took, the proof is in the pudding, Nico. This really,
well, thank you.
It really is. It's quiet. It's delicate. And I keep going back to delicate because as I'm watching it, and a lot of that has to do with Aikumi and her performance.
Yeah. There's absolutely.
There's a delicacy about her.
Yeah, and it's a quiet stoicism,
yes,
really, that she possesses throughout.
You know, and then you just bring in these elegant visuals and incorporating Mother Nature and the beautiful aspects of the world, of life. And, you know, we see, you know, greenery pops and we see little movement of wind and the surf comes in, not crashing, but languidly.
It stimulates the senses.
Yes, on every level. And everybody will be able to see Saragetto next week on the 20th.
Correct. Thank God. We release her to the world.
Now, are we going out in theaters or streaming?
Yes, we're gonna do a day-date theaters and online, and Gravitas would like to see it out to the world as quickly as possible. Theaters, unfortunately, aren't generating the way they did 5 or 10 years ago, right? So now it just seems to put it in everybody's hand to make their own decisions as to when they see it and how they see it and what format it's on. A plethora of networks to include Amazon Prime and Hulu and Fandango. It's sort of everywhere. So folks can see it at their leisure. And it's a film you need to see at your leisure in the wee hours of the morning. It's not a film I'd watch at 6 o'clock with some dinner. I'd probably watch it after a glass of wine at about 9:30.
Well, I want you to know that when I watched the film for the first time, because I've watched it twice now, and I will watch it a third time with no sound. But I was watching it at like 1 o'clock in the morning when it's dead silent.
Oh, perfect.
When there's nobody outside walking around the condo complex.
Perfect.
Nobody slamming doors. 1 o'clock in the morning.
It needs that.
You know, I've got all the lights off in the house and I'm just focusing on this imagery and this story unfolding on my screen.
Well, that's a perfect time to watch it.
Yeah. Oh, Nico, absolutely beautiful, beautiful.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
I can't wait for your next film.
Well, it won't take long.
I mean, any hints on what the next one's about?
Well, I'm working on the story of Natalie Wood and her fateful, tragic end.
Oh.
So it's a very heavy story also.
About
a very, as you know.
I know so that story well.
So there are some new details that are revealed in the film. And, you know, it's another tough story to tell. But I've been very passionate about that story for many years.
Well, and yes, and you mentioned new details. I mean, the hubbub just a few years ago when new details came out and they were talking about reopening an investigation into Robert Wagner and the whole nine yards.
This leans into all of that.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, this leans into it.
Yeah. Oh, I can't
wait. I'll keep you up to date on that.
Oh, please do. But that has to have entailed a lot of research.
Oh, my God.
For this
film. You have no idea. Traveling there and speaking to the folks that sort of were on site and nearby and the screams of help. And there's a very detailed dossier of details that come out in the film.
Oh, my God. I cannot wait. You have now piqued my interest beyond belief here with this, Nico.
Thank you, Debbie.
It's an early Christmas gift.
I appreciate you having interest, yeah.
It's an early Christmas gift for me. Tidbits on your next film.
Well, I'm glad Sarah Ghetto could bring some provocation of your emotions, too. I mean, that's what...
Oh, my God. Absolutely.
Yeah, the proud piece.
And you should be proud of it, because it is beautiful.
I hope folks understand it as well as you have.
I hope they do, too. Nico.
Yeah, it takes a lot. It's not something you could be texting and watching. You sort of need to focus on the film and really let it envelop you for 90 minutes.
Yeah. And 90 minutes, you've got it at the perfect length for this story.
Yeah.
The perfect length.
I felt that way. It could have gone longer, but I liked tight. 90 minutes was perfect to tell this story.
I think if you had gone longer, then it would feel a little draggy.
Exactly. And it was longer in the edit, and we sort of tightened it up, and I like it right where it's at.
I think it's perfect. Perfect where it's at.
Thank you, dear. I appreciate you.
Nico, thank you so, so much. And I hope to have you back on the show again next year.
Sure, we will. We'll talk about the next project.
Oh, my God.
Have a wonderful holiday, my dear, and let's talk again very soon.
You too.
Thank you, Debbie. Have a great day.
Thanks, Nico. Bye-bye.
Bye, dear.
And that was writer-director Nico Santucci talking about Sarah Ghetto. Next week, the 20th, in theaters and on all the usual suspect streaming platforms. You want to get in the Christmas spirit and have some fun? Simon Phillips' film, Silent Bite. It's on Prime. It's on other streaming platforms as well. I've watched it, as you heard me tell Simon, 5 times on Prime. I don't know why I didn't just buy it rather than pay for it to rent it 5 times. But, and I'll probably do it again just because I have so much fun watching Silent Bite with Christmas, a bank heist, and vampires. Everything I love. So that is all the time we have today. True to form, we ran a little bit over. 2 great films for you to take a look at. Also, hit up your theaters. Hit up your theaters and go see Day of the Fight. It is, Jack Houston has outdone himself. Michael Pitt stars. It's fantastic. Day of the Fight also has John Magaro, Ron Perlman, Steve Buscemi, Joe Pesci. It's a beautiful, beautiful film, an incredible story. It is one of my top picks of the year. Jack's film is one of my top picks of the year. And also, just came out on Friday. You want to have a lot of fun? Werewolves, starring Frank Grillo. Yes, Frank Grillo turns into a werewolf, people. It's Stephen C. Miller is the director, written by Matthew Kennedy. Just a lot of fun, a lot of action. Practical werewolves, people. Not CGI werewolves, practical werewolves. And then wonderful cinematography. But my interview with Stephen C. Miller is up on the website behindthelensonline.net now, as is my interview, my exclusive with Jack Houston. More to come. So, until next week, and our final show of the year, wrapping up year 10 of Behind the Lens. I'll be here next week. Frank Meyer was supposed to be here, but he is off shooting a music video. So Frank won't be here. I don't know who'll be here, but there'll be something for you. So until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.